Welcome, everybody. It's time again for the OC Spotlight, where we take a look at the most interesting people doing the most fascinating things right here in your own backyard. Today, we're very privileged to have with us one of the longtime voices here for Orange County, Orange Coast Magazine. Did I get that right, guys, here? Orange Coast Magazine and Marty Smith, the editor, along with Brian Connors, who normally hosts our Catapult Your Business show. Welcome, guys.
Thank you. Hey, Paul.
Tell me how many years Orange Coast Magazine. It seems like it's been here forever.
We've been around for 40 years. In fact, we're celebrating our 40th anniversary this year. Launched in 1974. Orange County's gone through a few changes since then.
And I'll bet. Yeah.
We had some fun in our October issue looking at the way styles have changed over those 40 years and other realities of life in Orange County.
There wasn't much of an Orange County then. We were just a sleepy little bedroom of adjunct to L.A., I would think.
Right.
It's been a heck of a ride.
And now, how big would Orange County be if it stood on its own, if it was its own media market? I know it's not considered one because we're under the umbrella of an even bigger one, L.A. still. But if Orange County was its own separate media market, wouldn't we be like in the top 10 or something?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, with 3.5 million people, that's many times bigger than cities like Pittsburgh or Minneapolis.
Yeah,
you think about it. Right. Yeah.
What would you say has been the evolution of Orange County? It's gone from being a sleepy backwater into what? A recognized international brand here with all the TV shows and everything that's taken place here.
It's interesting. The company that owns Orange Coast Magazine is called MS Communications, and they own six magazines. Orange Coast is one of the few that I think reflects an endemic problem in the Orange County media landscape.
Okay.
For example, one of the magazines we own is Texas Monthly.
Oh, yeah, a very popular, well-known magazine. Yeah.
It's called the National Magazine of Texas, and mm-hmm. the reason they call it that is because everybody knows what a Texan is.
This is true.
Everybody knows.
It's like a New Yorker.
Yeah,
a
New Yorker.
You know what a Texan eats, you know what a Texan drives, you know what a Texan likes to do on his day off.
Yeah.
Orange County, by contrast, is a collection of 34 cities, many of which have very little in common with the others.
Mm-hmm.
And part of our challenge at Orange Coast is to find those resonant chords that will mean just as much in Yorba Linda as they do in Newport Beach or San Clemente.
Right. Or Stanton or some other odd part of the county here.
Exactly. So trying to bring all that together and act as a coherent, unifying voice for that very diverse county is our monthly challenge. We enjoy it. We think we do pretty well at it, but it's a challenge that our sister publications in Los Angeles or Cincinnati or Indianapolis or mm-hmm. Atlanta really don't have.
Now, what other publications do they? Texas Monthly, that's very well known.
Texas Monthly, Los Angeles Magazine.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Cincinnati, Indianapolis Monthly, and Atlanta.
Wow, okay. Quite a diverse group of people. Now, the thing that struck me always about Orange County, and I say this to people around the country, I don't think there's another locale where people identify with the county and not just some city. When I lived in Detroit, you didn't say you were from Wayne County.
Right.
You don't say you're from, when you're in Dallas, you don't say you're from Tennant County. But here, somehow the identifying feature is the county itself. It's not any individual city area. Our airport is Orange County Airport.
Right, Interesting, yeah.
The newspaper in town is the Orange County Register. And I don't know if that just came about or if that was an evolution, but that seems to be totally unique. Is there any other place in the country that identifies, we think of ourselves based on the county?
Not many. We are certainly, and I was actually privileged to be part of that evolution back in 1985 when I moved here from Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
The Register was the Register. It was not the Orange County Register.
Yes, right. Before there was the Santa Ana or something Register.
There was the Santa Ana, and then Santa Ana stopped being as meaningful on a national level as Orange County did, and the Orange County Register made the choice. Let's brand it. Let's make Orange County a brand name. And then, its reputation and its public image for years was you know, very one-dimensional, very conservative, land of Nixon.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know, and it's gotten much more multidimensional. I'm not saying that necessarily in good ways. The Real Housewives of Orange County, you know, in some ways, you know, reinforced that.
Right.
You
Laguna know, Beach
Laguna
and all those
Beach,
shows.
Yeah.
Right. MTV shows.
So we suddenly have a national identity, whether it's the one we wanted or not, I don't know. But we do.
It seems to be surf and sun. There's a lot of surf companies and stuff here. It seems to be kind of this glitzy, glamorous, upscale image, although the county's not all fit that profile here. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Orange County, when I moved here, was a forgotten, you used to say, behind the orange curtain. You know, it was the backwater. It was the forgotten area. And now, in many ways, I think we're hipper, cooler than Los Angeles.
I'll give you an example. Every year we do an issue where we name the 10 best restaurants in Orange County, mm-hmm. or best new restaurants. We alternate them, either best restaurants or best new restaurants. This year we did best new restaurants, and the best new restaurant we named was called Little Sparrow in Santa Ana.
Hmm.
Bravo TV decided they were going to do a reality show called Best New Restaurants, and they were going to do this sort of bracketing system and try to come up with the best new restaurant in mm-hmm. America.
Sure.
When they went looking for potential candidates, they didn't just look in Los Angeles. They looked in Orange County, and up popped our story naming Little Sparrow.
Amazing.
Suddenly, Little Sparrow is going to be part of a national television program about best new restaurants.
Isn't that amazing?
And that's one of the changes I think we've all seen in the Orange County media landscape. People know we're here now, at least.
Yeah.
And pay attention.
And they pay attention.
And that is a differentiator, I think, at least in a positive way, I think, because, you know, growing up on the East Coast, in fact, I was just back in New York for the weekend, and, you know, a lot of people think about New York as far as, obviously, a lot of things, culture, but food is obviously very high on the list, right? And a lot has to do with the many little communities that are part of New York landscape, Little Italy, Chinatown, et cetera,
sure.
et cetera.
Right.
We do have that here, mm-hmm. which is a strength.
Large yeah. Vietnamese community, large on the border, a Cambodian community, some other Indian community on the border. We have a lot of different ethnic.
Growing Persian community in Irvine.
Yes, right.
And then obviously Hispanic and so forth. So we do have a very diverse county in terms of different type of population. And that mm-hmm. that is a very interesting strength, I think.
One of the shows we've been talking about trying to develop here for some time is a show that focused on, for want of a better, we keep wanting to call it Cocktail Nation or something, but there's a return to craft cocktails. There's a return. I'm not a big drinker, but if I'm going to have something, I want one of these old-fashioned, highly, what would I say it?
Labor-intensive.
Labor-intensive. There you go. That's the perfect way to put it. You know, where it's very entertaining, and he mixes all this. Got lots of different crazy things in it. And for a long time, I didn't think that was Orange County. And I can't tell you quite a number of little gastropubs or little bistros or little funny little places that are all sorts of doing crazy and unusual craft cocktails here. And it's all centered right here, and it's amazing what's happening. And little microbreweries opening up. We had the guy from Saddleback Brewery on and a couple others. I know there's one, the brewery up in Tustin and some other mm-hmm. places. Lots of cool little things happening that you wouldn't have thought in sleepy suburbia 20 years ago.
And I have to tell you, that is by far the most fun part of my job. We pride ourselves on covering the dining and cocktail scene in Orange County better mm-hmm. than anybody, mm-hmm. And in a way that we think is more credible. And we do that because that's one of those resonant chords I talked about. Everybody
yeah.
eats. Everybody, if they don't have the money to go out and eat, you know, five nights a week, they can at least aspire to going out on a Saturday night. They want to know where the good restaurants are, even if they only drop those names in the conversations at cocktail parties and never
yes.
go to them. We spend a lot of our resources, probably the bulk of our editorial resources, covering the dining scene. And it's so fun. And you're right.
We'll have to work with you on that, because I have, when I came to Orange County in the 80s, it was a whole different place, mm-hmm. obviously. I came a little after you guys started here. And I had been up in Hollywood and Los Angeles. I had been an entertainment press agent. I had worked with a lot of bars and restaurants up in that area doing that. And And Orange County was just nothing, you know, barren wasteland. And I remember then about, you jumped about 10 years ago around the turn of the century, I met the owners of OPA and a couple other places. They were down in Laguna Beach, and that was a hotbed, and there were a few places up and down the coast that you'd expect. Mm-hmm. And they were really debating whether they could move into like Aliso Viejo, Rancho Santa Margarita inland. That would people, they had the money, but were they... Did they have the sophistication? Did they have the interest? Did they have the palate? Did they have the appetite to try something new? Mm-hmm. And for a while, that was kind of, you know, would they do that? And now, boy, you see little interesting places. I like this little Sparrow. I never even heard of this. So, I mean, there's little places popping up. Downtown Santa Ana, you got that. Downtown
I wonder
Fullerton.
How his business is going, by the way.
Well, yeah, I'm sure he's thankful that he got noticed here. But sure. I'm saying there's little pockets in Fullerton and Santa Ana, the camp down the street here in Bristol. They're doing some really creative, fun things. And I think you're onto something. I think that really is a resonant chord. I'm not sure I would have said that 10, 20 years ago here.
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple of benchmarks in the history of evolution of dining in Orange County. One was Pascal Ohotz, who showed up, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s, and you know, brought French cuisine and French cooking to Orange County. Mm-hmm. I think the next major step was Zove Camarardian.
Oh, yeah, in Tustin over there.
Right, mm-hmm. She sort of brought Mediterranean food into, and I think if you want to find a kind of a ground zero for the explosion of food and dining in Orange County, you have to look at Zove. I mean, she was really critical for bringing that sort of higher-end sensibility.
And in Tustin, again, inland, from the coast. So.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, fascinating stuff. Right. So what other chords do you see here? What other resonances have you identified in the last few years that create a culture for us here?
I operate on a very simple editing mantra, and that is, let's assume our readers are smart, and let's assume they have a sense of humor about themselves and about the county. Those are resonant chords. You know, everybody either likes to think of themselves as smart or is smart, and likes to think of themselves as having a sense of humor, whether they do or not.
I like to think of myself as smart, but Brian really is smart.
Well, thank you, Paul.
I just think I'm smart. I act smart.
So if you can edit a magazine that hits those chords, you know, the chances are it will develop the audience that you want it to develop. And so we do, you know, for example, in our current issue, we've got a cover story on Orange County's grandest homes. It's pure voyeurism. We wanted to identify some really interesting homes in Orange County that people have maybe seen from the road or seen up on a cliff and have always wondered what it would look like inside.
What's that one in Laguna Beach? It's sort of round and on a point or
something? That's the one that's on the point. They've actually sort of torn it down, and they're rebuilding on that lot right now. But exactly, you know, the kind of homes you say, what about that one? We wanted to get inside some of those. So we spent, you know, a fair amount of the editorial space in that issue on that cover story looking inside those homes and telling the stories of who built them and why they built them and so forth. Five of the six are for sale, as a matter of fact. and our cutoff was about $20 million. So nothing below that. But on the other hand, we have a package of stories in that same issue called OC Confidential that looks at the sort of underground crime scene here in Orange County going back many years.
Underground crime scene.
I'm looking at, one right there, Mary Hong's forensic breakthrough.
You know, there have been many, many sort of criminal investigation breakthroughs by the Orange County Crime Lab, but that we looked at some of the really, really bad guys. We looked at the Ortega Highway, for example, as a notorious dumping ground for killers.
Is it really?
Interesting.
We looked at the
it's got an interesting map here, by the way, of it, yeah.
And the Pacific Ocean as, again, a place where bad things can happen. Hmm. The idea being that, you know, Orange County does have this image as a shimmering, glitzy haven from all bad things.
Yeah, right.
But if you look back over the last 30, 40 years, it's had its moments where you just think, okay.
Do we have notorious gangsters or gangs here or something?
Oh, you'd be surprised. And the story is not that it was intended to be a counterpoint to the Lux homes, but we try to be multidimensional. We try to look at the place in real terms, not in a creepy way, but trying to understand Orange County and all its
dimensions. It's more that all the glitters is not gold. It's more than the surface sheen here. Huh?
Right. Exactly.
Fascinating. Well, I am very, very intrigued to hear that, you know, somebody is out there trying to tell this story? Because in this world, that's what we're going to get to in the next segment here. Storytelling seems to be a lost art, and yet it's what the internet seems to want more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And I don't know in a world, I don't know how you tell stories in a Twitter world in 140 characters. I don't know how you tell it in a text world. I don't know how you tell it in a compressed, condensed, quick soundbite kind of world here. And so the fact that people are out there and investigating and thoughtfully looking for what's under the surface and telling those stories is very, very appealing to me here. And I think to the people that listen to these shows, too. Mm-hmm. What we've discovered is that podcasting is a storytelling medium, mm-hmm. and people will give you 20, 30 minutes because they're sitting in a car, or they're sitting at the gym, or they're sitting somewhere. They're trying to multitask and kill some time, and they're willing to give you a prolonged period of time to talk about something here, mm-hmm. as opposed to video, which I still think is quick, emotional. My opinion, and I don't want to sound biased because I'm in audio, but I think video is useful for telling story, maybe long form in a movie or something here. But you know, the little snippets you get on the 6 o'clock news don't really tell much of a story to me.
No, absolutely. And I, you talk about Twitter. I mean, I look at things like that as sort of the breadcrumbs along the trail. And if you can pick up a hint of something going on in the world by mm-hmm. Twitter.
Absolutely.
And follow that to its logical source, whatever it links to, and maybe get a little bit more information. And then follow that to a place where you can actually get, you know, the depth story. That's great. And, you know, what scares me is a little bit is that I see a lot of people following it to that first link, getting the Huffington Post version of whatever reality is,
right.
and not going back to the source. You know, where did that Huffington Post piece come from?
Yes.
You know, likely from a credible, you know, news organization that did its research. And, you know, I don't see my kids' generation, for example, taking that extra step and going
beyond. No, they take it right on the surface. I saw this. That must be the
sound bite.
Exactly. So, and this, well, I'm going to set this up. We're going to take a commercial in just a second here. But what I want to get into is who in this upheaval of traditional media, where newspapers are disappearing and radio stations are going out of business and TV stations are losing an audience and to online things, who is out there pulling those threads together? Who is there to analyze the news? Who is there to investigate things? Who is there to tell the story and pull all these different pieces together? I want to hear about that and how you guys continue to do that in a world that is there are fewer and fewer resources to do that. So I'm intrigued how you're doing that and how it's working and how you're paying for it and all the kind of things that we want to get into when we talk about the changing media landscape. So all that and more when we come right back.
UPS Protection has been protecting systems in the U.S. against brownouts, blackouts, and poor quality power for over 25 years. We provide power protection systems, including UPS, lighting inverters, generators, and service for clients from coast to coast. We specialize in solving all your power needs. As a direct reseller of the best brands in the industry, including Liebert, Powerware, and APC, we can solve all your power protection needs. Protecting your power is our main goal. We offer on-site or depot repair of our critical equipment. To better serve your budget constraints, UPS Protection also offers both reconditioned and new products.
When you use the Premier Rewards Gold Card from American Express, the rewards points can keep on multiplying. By 3 with triple points on airfare. By 2 with double points on gas and groceries. And a single point for pretty much every other dollar you spend on the card. Then, start choosing from over a million rewards to redeem all those points. Apply today and the annual fee for the first year is all on us. Call 1-800-AXP-GOLD or visit AXPGold.com. The annual fee for the card is $175. See terms, conditions, and restrictions at AXPGold.com.
Okay, this is going by way too fast. I'm hopeful that we can entice him to come back and do some more of these conversations here, because this is fascinating stuff for me. We talked about the mission of Orange Coast Magazine and its long history here of telling the story of Orange County and how that story has changed over time here. Now, I really want to, and I hope this isn't a sensitive subject here, but it's really on everybody's mind here. what is media going to look like a few years from now? And will there be anybody, what should we say here, looking at all this stuff and pulling all these threads together here? Or are we just going to be left with a world of Twitter and random thoughts and rumors, internet rumors and sound bites and everything else, and it's going to be up to us to try and figure out what it all means?
I think we're halfway between what we were and what we're going to be. and the hard part of that is not knowing what we're going to look like. But I don't. Do you? It's hard for me to imagine what it's going to look like. There's a couple things, though, that I do know to be true.
Okay.
The appetite for storytelling has not gone away.
No.
That has been with us since the dawn of man. It will be with us forever. The need for information is greater than it's ever been. How we distribute that information is the question that we're all trying to struggle with. And how we value that information. I've had the conversation recently with a number of people, particularly journalists, trying to sort of open their eyes to the reality that what we do and what we cherish and what we have held dear since my generation graduated in the Woodward and Bernstein era.
Yeah, right.
What we hold true has been devalued. That you can get information free from citizen journalists all over the world, and nobody's willing to pay for that.
Right. But it's instant, which has some value to it. It's overwhelming in the amount of stuff that comes to you. It's what Marshall McLuhan talked about in the 60s and 70s or whenever he wrote those books about information overload. And yet, nobody edits it or verifies or checks any of it. So it's all just instant reaction. It's all just raw and knee-jerk reactions to things, many of which turn out to be false over time.
And it's, that's the scary thing for me, because right now it's good enough. And that's a scary thing for a country such as ours, a society such as ours, that depends on an informed electorate, and that depends on knowing that, what your public officials are up to, knowing what, businesses in your community are up to. That's good information. And I think people are still willing to pay for that information, but they want it in narrower and narrower niches. And all of those niches have to do with individual products or services or businesses. And nobody is thinking in terms of the greater good. Nobody is thinking in terms of, we need to do this because people need to know what's going on.
Right. What do you think, Brian? You see this in the financial world, where now, as a financial advisor, people have more information at their disposal than ever before. But we've talked about before, in some ways, it just paralyzes them.
Well, yeah, and I think you're right.
Because there's no analysis.
Right. There's no analysis. There's a lot of lack of trust. And I'm just thinking from my personal, what I've been doing, and particularly on the business side, it's one thing, which the publication, I think, has done a very good job, is the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. Their articles are well written. I think they're well researched. Obviously, they're catering to their target market very well, because there's a lot of financial people out there that really need good quality information and willing to pay for it. So I think they've been pretty successful as far as I'm concerned. I think I know for a fact that you have to pay for that. And like a lot of publications, they're struggling to try to find a way to come up with a business model.
And if I'm not mistaken, they're the only one, other than the experiment going on with our own local newspaper, the Orange County Register, they're the only paid firewall up, or one of the few, on the Internet, aren't
they? Right, right. Yeah. Then on the other side, I find myself more gravitating to different places on the web, where I try to find different points of view from my angle. And then, of course, I go to traditional news media. But I think even myself, I'm becoming more suspicious of the news media, because it is biased. Right now, we've got like bulkheads of political persuasions and
all these little echo chambers where they're shouting to each other.
Right.
Know?
So you gotta, as a person that wants to be informed, I'm finding myself, yes, I have my bias and preference, of course, but then I want to check some other sources that I go on the web, where I can find some what I think is some pretty intelligent, independent thought. But it's hard, because it's coming from everywhere, like you said. And the sad thing about it is, I think there's a group of us out there that have either given up, or they just have given up trying to get what I consider a balanced perspective on what are important issues. And you can probably just by your own just monitoring things, you can ask certain people certain questions, real basic ones. And for whatever reason, they're not interested in some of the basic things.
Doesn't anybody want thoughtful analysis, informed analysis? Like, I used to love reading the New York Times or the LA Times. I know everybody hates the LA Times. It's too liberal or whatever down here. But I always thought they had what I loved about it. They did, you know, you could turn for pages and pages. I mean, they did really in-depth stories. You may not have liked the, I didn't think they were that biased, but maybe that's my perspective here. But I guess the point is, and then USA Today came along and said, no, we're going to do everything in little snippets and make them pretty and little boxes, and they're all on one page. And it started that trend, which is only accelerated with the internet and social media, shorter, simpler, quicker, just little sound bites. And you can't really get into any in-depth discussion in
right.
one column.
And just one little note about this. It's interesting. I had a conversation with a friend of mine, and this is kind of scary, that if you are going on the web and looking for news and information about whatever kind of things you're trying to find, because you can set up the filters for your search, that now you're only getting the ones that you want to read. And it's kind of, I don't think that's healthy. Because if there's a particular type of news you're looking for, you might just get the one version of the publication that somehow gravitates to you, but doesn't really give you an independent perspective. So I think there's a little bit of that going on, too, when you think about, you know, the major search engines and what people
read. So we've just gone back to yellow journalism in the days of William Randolph Hearst, that he would write whatever he wanted to sell. If he wanted the country to go to war against Cuba or Spain, then he would slant the stories and leave out the other facts that, you know, he was trying to create sensationalism.
Well, I mean, look at how, you know, the digital realm operates. It's all, you know, clickbait. You know, in some cases it's, you know, women in bikinis, and another it's, you know, it's a political perspective. But what you're trying to do is build an audience that is interested in what you're interested in giving them. Mm-hmm. And you're right. That's a very, very narrow way to go about it. I do have a friend, very conservative politically for very good reasons. He lost a son in 9/11. So in terms of, you know, his financial politics, his geopolitical politics, very, very conservative. But when he sends me stories, which he does every day, that he's found on the internet, they come from Rolling Stone. They come from The Atlantic. They come from. So I know he's reading omnivorously.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I respect that.
Sure.
You know, he is seeking out, you know, those points of view that he doesn't necessarily agree with.
Sure.
to get that balance. But that puts the onus on the individual.
Yes.
To chase those things down and to seek them out, whereas it might be a little more comfortable just to be in the echo chamber and to hear what you want to hear. Mm-hmm. I think he's a very rare individual these days.
And you talked about in your publication how you try and find the not obvious stories in the county, the stories that maybe nobody else is telling here, the threads that nobody else has picked up on. You were talking about the crime scene. That's not one I would associate. I would never think about is there a organized crime scene here in Orange County? I guess there must be, but that's not part of our image and our public perception of ourselves here. And so if nobody's out at looking for those stories or telling those stories, then they just get overlooked and ignored. And
my filter is very simple. If this is a story, or it could be a story that just drags me by the eyeballs all the way through 4,000 words, I want to publish that story. I'll give you a good example. The story that in the last year that just jumps out at me was called Center of the Universe. I got this. We ran a story in spring of 2013. It was called Why Isn't Randy Kraft Dead? Now, Randy Kraft was a notorious serial killer who was arrested in Orange County with the body of his latest victim in his car.
Okay.
He has literally been 30 years on death row in California.
Wow.
You know, why isn't Randy Kraft dead? It was a way of us looking at, you know, California's dysfunctional death penalty system. Whether you agree with it or not, it ain't working.
No. Well, because we theoretically have a death penalty, but I don't think we've executed anybody in...
Right.
Years.
It's been 20 years.
Right.
So we did a follow-up in the wake of that story. I got an email from a guy who lived in Georgia, but he says, you know what? Randy Kraft preyed on Marines, particularly around Camp Pendleton. Those were many of his victims. And this guy wrote and said, you know what? I was a Marine in 1980. I was seduced by a guy in a San Clemente motel room. This guy met me at the beach. He was the most personable guy I've ever met. So I started doing some research, and lo and behold, I found a picture of Randy Kraft, and my God, that was the guy.
Wow.
That's a story you can't stop reading.
Sure. Yeah.
Because
sure.
This guy had a ringside seat with a world-class sociopath for an entire afternoon where Kraft spent the day seducing him and trying to, and this was a guy as an unreconstructed heterosexual.
And lived to tell about it. Yeah.
And lived to tell about it because he did not drink the beer that had the drugs in it that Kraft offered him. You know, it was a survivor story. It was, you could not put this story down. And it continues to drive more traffic on our website than anything else. It's been, you know, the New Yorker wrote about this story. And, you know, here in Little Orange County, the fact that the New Yorker is writing about a story like that.
Sure.
That's what we're looking for.
What about history? I'm a history buff. I studied history in college. And so few people are interested in history, and particularly in Southern California, here where we rewrite history. We pave it over every couple of years. We tear it down and start all over again. And yet there is history to this region. There is history. I know it doesn't go back hundreds and hundreds of years, perhaps, but the story of how things evolved and where they came from and people who've been here, and I think of John Wayne's boat or something over there in those days, and all those stories and the wild times that they had there or something, or, you know, I think didn't Bogart and Bacall, I think, live down there too or something off of the point for a while, and some others. And I'm just always fascinated with those kind of stories, and they just seem to all get lost all the time.
One of our cover story in our December 2014 issue is called Growing Up in Orange County.
And that's great.
And for that, we went back to people who did grow up here. Everybody from, you know, Will Ferrell and Steve Martin to Joyce Hoffman, who was the first female world champion surfer, to Loretta Sanchez, to Marissa Wayne, John Wayne's daughter. She told the great story of spending weekends on her dad's yacht, the Wild Goose, in Newport Harbor. And, you know, she didn't clean her room, and he kept saying, clean your room. This is on the boat. At one point, you know, he took all of her belongings out to the railing and started dropping them into the harbor. Very John Wayne way to deal with it.
Yeah.
So you get, you know, you get glimpses of Orange County that was, you know, when we do pieces like that.
I think there's so much need for it, because, again, if you don't know where you came from, how do you know where you're going? I think that's part of what, you know, what holds the tribe together are the stories of the past, as well as what we all, the common interests that we share. Yeah, and so I just don't think we have many common stories, like maybe because we all came from somewhere else here and we're just reinventing ourselves. But that in itself is kind of a story. I don't know.
You know, the one thing I think we legitimately lay claim to is the surf culture here.
Yes. Right.
And you alluded to that earlier. Mm-hmm. You know, it grew up as a cultural phenomenon that was embraced and adopted all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Rich tradition.
And not up in L.A. so much. I mean, this was, you know, you listen to the Beach Boys. It was all Orange County. It was from kind of the airport down or something here. Yeah.
And all those people that were the early adopters of that culture started businesses, and those businesses have grown into the Hurleys and the Quicksilvers.
Yes, right.
That are a huge part of our local economy.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, that's a rich tradition in that. But I think Orange County's really got a very evolving culture, and fascinating to me because, like you said, it's very diverse in many respects, and it's changing so rapidly. It's phenomenal. And
so when did you get here, Brian? I came here in the 80s.
Okay. So I moved down here at 85.
Okay.
And main reason it was is primarily I was starting a family, and I wanted to grow up in a community, a suburban community, and yet I'd be still close enough to Los Angeles, kind of like the way, you know, other big communities like in Long Island, New York, where I grew up originally, the suburbia, which became quite a big population itself in Long Island. Orange County, she had that. But really, all the businesses in L.A. for most of the 80s until basically the 90s started to really change things. You had a few tech companies down here, like Western Digital and a few others, Beckman Instruments, of course. But, no, I've seen a tremendous change. I mean, I remember driving just by right here. I think there was, Great Western Bank, and there was another building. And
there were bean fields. Like, I was a bean field.
Yeah, Strawberry Farms right here Segerstrom, right? I mean, and that whole thing, that whole transformation, the orange fields of Irvine, which essentially was very limited building on, until east of the 405 for many years. So I've seen a tremendous change. But I think Orange County is just a very interesting place from where people think about lifestyle, I think, is number one, and work and what you do with your living is number two. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a very unique combination.
More so than I lived in Pittsburgh as a kid, I confess. I lived in Bethel Park when I was for a couple of years.
I'm an Upper St. Clair boy.
See, you're across the way. You're arch rivals. And my father was an executive with Chrysler, so we moved around the country. He was a regional manager there and in Milwaukee and in Detroit multiple times. I went to high school and college and all that kind of stuff. And so I'm very familiar with all those old Rust Belt kind of cities here. And, California was just, the Beach Boys, the sun, it was sun and surf and everything. So I couldn't wait to come to California when I graduated.
Well, if you look at the demographics, I think, a little bit, and maybe that's changing now, but a large group of people do actually work for themselves in Orange County or have small businesses. It's been largely driven by small business, and I think a lot of that was a lot of people, including myself, that used to work for a Fortune 500 technology company. I really wanted to have a lifestyle. So it was, Orange County represented, like you said, the surf tradition, the beach community, the fun and sun type of mentality. And yes, oh, by the way, I need to make a living too.
And we're willing to pay more for it, and we're willing to sacrifice. I know people that have turned down transfers out of Orange County. Don't want to leave. They could make more money somewhere else.
Sure.
Don't want to leave.
While all that is going on, the culture itself, I think, has been enriching itself enormously. Go back to the idea of how we cover dining in the magazine. We were covering all the sort of white tablecloth restaurants and the high-end stuff, and we realized, we're missing a lot of really good stuff.
Absolutely.
The Persian community, the Vietnamese community.
Yeah.
And so we created a page in the magazine every month called The Global Diner, where we just simply pull out baklava. We're going to celebrate baklava this month, and we're going to give you three places in Orange County to go find it at its best. Mm-hmm. Tamales, whatever. Mm-hmm. It deeply enriched our presentation of Orange County to the public, but that's because we're simply reflecting, the sort of deep.
That, I think, is a change. We're broadcasting across from, at the Tech Space Center across from South Coast Plaza. Within walking distance of here, there's a whole shopping center up the corner here where they have a Mary Sue Feniger and what's her partner's name that did the Border Grill. They have this thing called Bella Cuba, I think it is. Mm-hmm. It's their Cuban take. And then within that same center, there's Inca Mamas, which does a Peruvian, really wonderful stuff. And then there's a Vietnamese, and there's a Indian, and there's a Greek, and it's amazing. I would have never thought there would be that kind of, this was kind of the last bastion of white bread Midwesternism to me, when I first came here. It looked like, sort of Detroit, but sunny.
And there's another facet to this. It's kind of like this live your dream lifestyle, too. People here, for a while, at least till the big Great Recession hit, it was, bigger is better, and,
The McMansions.
Get the bigger house, and the nice, everybody's driving around in nice cars, and which is, it looks great, but it's obviously this
bigger
mindset.
Breasts, bigger.
everything's somewhat enhanced, and, But it's to be honest with you, I think even in my own case, like you said earlier, Paul, if it came down to for reasons for work that you had to consider leaving Orange County, I think a lot of people just says, I'll just figure out what else I'm going to do.
Yeah. Right. So what brought you here, Marty, and what's kept you here all these years?
I was a newspaper reporter in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and had the job I'd always wanted to have. I was writing for the magazine for the Pittsburgh Press, and I got this offer from the Orange County Register, and so they sent me a bunch of copies of it. This was in 1985.
Did you have to pull out a map and say, where's Orange County?
I did, kind of. it meant nothing to me, but they sent me these copies of the paper, and I'm looking at it, and I'm reading stories about whale migrations and stuff that I just didn't read about much in Pittsburgh. And I just thought, this could be really fun. And so I came with that in mind, this is a chance to learn a new place, to understand. And keep in mind, 1985 was the tail end of the steel industry meltdown in Pittsburgh.
Yes, yep, right.
So I'd been covering layoffs and downsizing and the sort of general malaise of the economy there for a number of years. And that was just exhausting because you saw people struggling and you saw businesses, you know, struggling.
And Pittsburgh, from what I've understood, we have some other hosts here from Pittsburgh, has really found a way to revive itself with healthcare and some other things, but for a long time, like, I don't think Detroit really has. That's where I'm mostly from, is Detroit. Detroit's still, they're in bankruptcy. They're still struggling to figure out what they're going to be, if they're ever going to be anything on the same scale that they were. But Orange County, really from the 80s, I mean, this is a brand new community, a brand new culture that came, that broke off of Los Angeles. And people always assume, well, you're really part of Los Angeles or maybe even San Diego. No, people in Orange County really hate that image. That's another unifying thing. We're not, what we are, wherever we are, we're not L.A.
Right. You know, and interesting what you say there, you know, during this recent recession, obviously a lot of people took a big financial hit, mm-hmm. at least, you know, lost their homes and all this stuff. But did you notice that when you were going out, that you were, all the parking lots were full at where the restaurants mm-hmm. were? And it was like, wait a minute, is this real? We just had this huge, you know, we were the epicenter of the
Starbucks
subprime mortgage crisis,
right?
And yet you'd go out to restaurants, I know mm-hmm. where we were living, and you'd see them always packed and full. So it was fascinating. So I think what I'm getting at is I see the ability for people really to adapt pretty well here. Mm-hmm. It's a very, I would consider, educated particular group of people that live in Orange County, with Northern Orange County, Southern Orange County. There's people are here to move forward in their lives and to build a lifestyle for themselves.
And I'll tell you something else. Just two observations. One is when I actually came to L.A. in 1980, and actually lived, I'm exaggerating when I moved to Orange County. I think it was more in the 90s when I came here, because I lived up in L.A. through about 88, 89 or whatever, and I was in the entertainment industry, and I thought that was the epicenter of the world, and Orange County was just some backwater. I would come down and visit here. And, of course, how the world changes. I remember visiting Mission Viejo, which they had just built, this master plan community. I thought, yuck, who would live here? It all looks the same. It's all clean and very sterile. And then I'm trying to raise a family in the 90s. Suddenly I come down and go, oh, look at this. It's all clean and sterile and nice. You know, same thing, but I had a different reaction to it. But if I was going to tell somebody in other parts of the country to come to California, and other than Silicon Valley, which is still a very powerful creation of ideas and stuff here, I really feel like we have moved. There is more interesting stuff going on in Orange County than there is up in L.A. L.A. feels like it's kind of stagnated a little bit, other than the entertainment industry, which continues to thrive. The aerospace industry went away. And in place down here in Orange County, you've got the gaming industry, things like Blizzard and some of these other companies down here. You've got the whole surf industry and the surf culture world here. You've got the oceans and you've got the mountains and you've got other sorts of things here. I think there's a lot, and there's definitely some high tech and stuff here. It seems like there's a lot more going on here than even up in L.A. Am I just biased?
No, let's take the Irvine Company as an example.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
I came here in the mid '80s and was perfectly willing to accept that this county was mostly owned by rapacious land developers
right.
who were going to pave every square inch of Orange County.
Right.
But look what's happened. I mean, the Irvine Company built it out as much as they could. They wrung as much profit from it as they could, and.
Yeah.
For whatever reasons, whether it be a tax break or just doing the right thing, they decided, you know what, let's leave these 60,000 acres in the middle of the county undeveloped.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
Look what the Moiso family did
exactly.
They built out the last of their ranch, the Spanish land grant that they held.
And I had the pleasure of having breakfast with Tony Moiso about six mm-hmm. or 8 months ago, and listening to him talk about, you know, Donald Bren was this upstart developer that was taking Tony around and showing him, okay, here's what I did here. Here's how I built that, and sort of the lessons that Tony Moiso learned. And here we are 30 years later, and I'm looking at these guys and saying, you know what? They kind of did the right thing.
Yeah.
And that's in perpetuity.
And I've read in other places that in the process they created a what would you call it, a paradigm, a map, a roadmap of how to build master plan communities.
Right.
We really invented master plan or perfected them here. There's some in Florida and some other places and way back when, you know, in New Jersey and stuff. But we really took the idea of a master plan community where you had multiple levels of income all existing in the same area. So it wasn't just a wealthy community and everybody had to drive in and work there and then left and the service workers had to come from out. But this idea of having you start off and there's places for apartments and then there's condos and then there's houses and then there's huge houses and you can move up or down in that strata there. But everybody, you don't have to travel very far. The people, the service people who are working at Starbucks and stuff live in the same community here.
One of the things I was struck by about 6 years ago was the city of Irvine kept turning up in the the FBI uniform crime statistics as the safest city in the United States.
Yeah, Mission Viejo was always up there too. Yeah.
And it had about a 3-year run going as the safest city in the United States, and you know, which made me think, okay, they got it right. You know, this is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And one of the favorite stories we developed out of that reality was, it was called 10 Great Reasons to Resent Irvine. And it was, Irvine is more diverse than wherever you live. Irvine schools are better than wherever you live. Its roads and parks are better than wherever you live.
Well thought out, well planned.
It's safer. And, you know, it's just one thing after another. The theory became reality. You know, what they envisioned, the way they built those neighborhoods, the way they designed those neighborhoods discouraged criminals from coming in because the way they're laid out, you can't get out very easy.
But at the same time, there are different economic strata built into that, too. Not everybody in Irvine, you know, is wealthy. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, my dad was an executive, so we lived in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, which was the big upper-class suburb that everybody dreamed of. And it was just typical white flight. Everybody in our community looked like me. You know, everybody was white and well off. And the workers who had to come in and work in the hotels or the fast food restaurants had to drive in and leave every day. Mm-hmm. In the same way that down in Los Angeles, they had to drive across the bridges and over from East LA to go downtown in the old days when the aristocracy lived downtown there. And then they had to leave. And that was always the model. You know, there aren't any poor areas of Beverly Hills. You know, you drive in and you drive out. But here they've got different strata built in so that you can work, be a service worker and live in an apartment there and some lower income housing all the way up to multi-million dollar mansions.
And that is one of the benefits of having, say, one or two people that had the right vision in terms of a master plan. So they actually worked out where you could work within 10 miles of mm-hmm. or 5 or 10 miles of where you lived.
Right.
And yet you would have your schools here and the places to go where you'd go for entertainment here.
And we don't have to drive very far.
No, you don't have to drive very far. You can just
unlike
stay right
LA,
there.
Where you know you have to drive everywhere, or Detroit, or other places like that. You have to drive long distances here.
And believe me, I'm as cynical as the next guy. I'm a cynic from way back. But when I step back, and
I like
look
that
at,
about you, Marty.
Yeah, thanks. But when I step back and look at how this place has evolved, I think, you know what? This is extraordinary. Right. This is really extraordinary.
Well, let's talk about how the magazine evolved right after this. We're going to come right back and wrap this up and bring it all back full circle and see how the magazine's evolved and where it's going from here. So stick around.
There's something positive about the word up. When things are looking good, they're looking up. When someone's down, you cheer them up. So how do you move up? Well, when it comes to getting your bachelor's or master's degree, there's one university that stacks up, Brandman University. Brandman is ranked by U.S. News & World Report as one of the nation's top 10 universities for online bachelor's programs. Brandman's online graduate programs in business and education also receive top honors. So look us up at brandman.edu. Brandman University. Move up.
S&H Rubber is a manufacturing company in Fullerton, California. We specialize in custom molded, extruded, and stamped rubber parts. If your next job requires a rubber part, we would appreciate the opportunity to quote on it. We serve aerospace, automotive, and many other industries. We work with many types of rubber, including silicone, EPDM, neoprene, buna-nitrile, and Viton. Our quality system is ISO and AS9100 approved. Over our 47 years in business, the S&H brand has become known for superior quality, quick turnaround, and competitive pricing. Please check out our website at www.shrubber.com or call 714-525-0277. Let S&H be your sealing solution.
Imagine what it would feel like to lose everything. Your job, your home, your family, your dignity. This has happened to thousands of the men, women, veterans, and young adults we serve at Working Wardrobes. What do we do to help? We provide career development services, life skills workshops, job skills training. We provide the perfect interview outfit, and we get clients placed in jobs. Call Working Wardrobes, 714-210-2460. Donate, volunteer, invest, hire.
All right, we're here with Marty Smith, editor of Orange Coast Magazine, and who's seen it all, as have everybody in this room. And Brian Connors, who normally hosts our show, Catapult Your Business, a financial planning show here. And we're just recollecting all things Orange County here. And I just kind of want to bring it back in our last 10 minutes or so here and talk about the magazine again here. Where does the magazine go in this world of diminished media? Print is dead. Nobody knows what's going to happen. I mean, you guys are bucking the trend, and you're producing a high quality. We were marveling. It's a thick, well-read, easy-to-read publication. It's not all just breezy stuff. You got some in-depth, interesting storytelling. How you doing it?
Well, we benefit by having a corporate owner that believes in high-quality editorial content and credibility of that editorial content.
Mm-hmm. So how do they do it? How does Texas Monthly survive, and LA Magazine, which has been around, seems like, forever as well, and doing the same sorts of things here?
They believe that, you know, that there is a demand for that. There is an audience for that. And, in fact, there is. Now, that audience is changing in the way it consumes our content. A lot of it ends up digital. I mean, a lot of content we create strictly for the digital world.
Hmm. So if I went to your website, are there stories that I wouldn't see in the publication?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
There are videos, there's audio, there are things that you simply can't get in print. You know, it's an enhanced version of the magazine.
Well, as I said offline, we're going to offer you some of these business conversations too, if you want to utilize these and provide another rich media content for your readers and audience and
That's
stuff.
That's great. Here. You know, one of the approach that we're taking right now, and I think you see it in a lot of publications. You know, we've recognized that the print magazine is going to break even probably at best, because print is very expensive to produce.
Oh yeah,
sure. The paper,
beautiful color pictures in here,
and you haven't. You've resisted what so many have not resisted. You haven't shrunk the size. Has the magazine gotten smaller in size? Not just in the number of pages, but in the actual physical size of it?
We did a resizing of it about 7 years ago when we completely changed the format of it. But it was for design reasons, not for money-making reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we wanted it to look like a monthly city magazine.
Yes, right.
It was oversized before. But you know, the approach we're taking now is we, you know, it's the basic freelancer's rule of sell everything three times. Okay, so we're generating
sell every three times. Okay, so explain that to me. I've never heard that one either.
That's how you make a living as a freelancer, because you know, you write a story for one publication, and then you use the content that you gathered for that to write a story for another publication,
and then
you do a blog post for somebody else. That's how you break from break even into profitability.
Okay,
so in our example, say we do our Best Restaurants issue, and it's the cover story of our print issue, and it's much talked about and buzzed about. Okay, that's great. So then we move that into the digital realm, and every day we tease to, okay, you know, here's the third restaurant of our 10, and we drive traffic to our website that way. We have a dining newsletter, an electronic dining newsletter that we sell sponsorships for. Do you want to be part of our dining audience? If so, you know, Sub-Zero or you know, one of the companies that caters to a dining crowd,
right?
You want to be part of this because we reach a very rarefied audience of high-end foodies. You can reach them through us. So we sell it, you know, digitally. And then we try and move that into the realm of events. Okay, so we have a big party, a launch party for that issue.
Very smart.
We invite the restaurants that have been named to the top 10. All the chefs show up. They have a cooking station. They prepare some little morsel to distribute. They, you know, they meet our audience. We bring our audience directly to them.
You've got to put us on your media list. I got to come to you because I'm a real foodie, and I would love to come cover this stuff and talk about it. And that is so smart, because in the old days, a community publication
had to get out and meet the community. I grew up in doing radio. I did radio back east in Virginia and other places. And we used to do remotes. Every radio station did remotes. That was their bread and butter. You know, you went out to the Ford dealership and you did a live remote from there or something. And that only made money, but you got to meet the public and they got to meet you and you felt involved. They weren't just voices floating through the air here. Mm-hmm. I think radio stations got away from that as they got to syndicated content, and half of these are robotic stations now. There is nobody in the studio anymore here. And the same thing with publications, where they're just picking up Associated Press and other pieces from around the country. There is nobody in the newsroom anymore.
I've been startled by, for example, our Best Restaurants event every year. The restaurants are, A, honored to be on the list. They are more than happy to cooperate and send staffers out to cook at this event.
Sure, why not?
To donate, you know, the cost of it. We then can get liquor sponsors. We can get car sponsors. We can get people to help us underwrite the cost of staging it.
Yeah.
And then we can get, you know, the people that want to be at that event and be part of it to pay for a ticket. Again, selling everything three times. That's how you...
Amazing.
These become the life support systems for the print product.
And in the process, you create a community. You create
exactly.
These people feel attached to you. I don't know that I feel attached to KABC anymore here, radio or TV. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I feel any personal connection with them. Mm-hmm. But I sense that what you're doing is creating people who have more than just a readership, they feel a connection to the publication.
And that goes not just for readers, but advertisers. You know,
this is
you talk about direct advertising. If you can bring your readership who is interested in fashion or food or whatever directly into a boutique or directly into a restaurant and say, hey, Wednesday night, everybody on our food list, our dining list, on our newsletter, we can send out an e-blast and sort of say, you know what, we're having an event on Wednesday night at this restaurant. You know, it'll cost you $20, but it's, you know, two glasses of wine and hors d'oeuvres. You know, what restaurant wouldn't like to have that kind of audience brought directly to their
door? What a great business model. Yeah. So it makes sense. You found a way that where it isn't just print, and that which is very expensive, as you said, particularly the way you guys do it, high gloss paper, high, you know, good stock, good size, thick publication here. That's a very expensive way to publish something here, and not many people are still doing that. But you're saying that you take that content and reuse it on the web, and then you reuse it in live events, and it starts to pay for itself.
And what makes all that possible is the credibility of that content. The idea that, you know, this is not dining reviews that are paid for by the advertiser.
Yes, I hate that.
Yeah. When you can promise people that and follow through on that promise and deliver.
They trust your publication then.
Exactly.
I was, my only foray into written word was back in, I guess, the end of the 90s here. I got a gig through a roundabout way. I was a freelance restaurant writer for the Riverside Press Enterprise, and they used to give us the freedom to really write in-depth pieces, and of course they insisted that the paper pay for them so that we didn't go in there and get free meals or something here. And that lasted for a couple of years, and then, you know, that was just too expensive to do, and and they changed the whole model. As you said, it was you run an ad and you get a little advertorial kind of thing here. And I just thought, what a shame, because we weren't trying to blast anybody, but we were trying to give an honest view of what was there. My view was always I wasn't trying to find what was wrong with it. I was trying to find what was right with it.
Right.
And so, you know, each restaurant I try and say, this is what I like the best. I didn't necessarily like this, but this is what I really wanted to focus on, because I thought that people wanted to read about where they could go, not just telling them don't go there, if that makes sense.
Know, the fact is that our editorial space is so valuable. Why would you waste time telling people where not to go?
Yes, right.
Right.
We look at everything that we review as a recommendation. If we're going to review it, it's passed the sniff test. It's we've been there three times.
Right.
We're convinced that it's worth recommending. Now, we may recommend it as a one-star restaurant as opposed to a four-star restaurant, but we do recommend it because they're doing something right there.
Right.
And if it's not worth reviewing, we just ignore it.
You know, it's interesting. I'm looking at the pub, Paul and Marty, and you know, I'm thinking about them in a nice hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sitting
of
on
which
my...
there are many.
Right. And this is sitting on my, you know, table.
Right.
And I picked this up, and because of what the beautiful color and, like you said, the glossy pages and the content and then the whole thing, it feels like a resource to me. You know, that if I want to look up something about what's happening in Orange County, I see OC Snaps. And then I see something about, you know, there's some story and history about what's going on. And I'm also seeing, what's happening in some of the educational aspects. And where do I go to eat?
That's a whole other market to the whole visitors. We get a lot of Disneyland, and we're a big tourist destination here as well. I never thought of that, of driving those people to someplace.
Gives you an overview about what's going on in the county in multiple ways, which I think is pretty neat. I mean, you don't see that very often.
So what's the publication cost? And I'm embarrassed to say I don't subscribe to it. I'm going to change that when we get done here. I'm going to subscribe to this. I got to get reacquainted with Orange County, Orange Coast Magazine.
We appreciate the support. If you buy it on the newsstand, it's $4.95. And we do sell a third of our sales are newsstand sales. We're the only newsstand magazine.
I was going to say, this isn't just a giveaway, folks. This isn't just the Orange County Weekly where they're throwing it on anywhere or something. Nothing wrong with Orange County Weekly, but it's a different kind of publication. Yeah.
We sincerely believe that people are willing to pay for quality, and that's what we try to deliver them. Now, that said, you can get a year's subscription for $12. So, you know, why you would pay $4.95 every month on the newsstand, I'm not sure.
Right.
We appreciate them doing that.
Right.
But there's a much easier and less expensive way to do it.
And do you get digital content with that as well, or is that digital content free? Because that's one of the big problems we haven't really even addressed here is, you know, the traditional media got used to giving it away for free, and now people think it's always free on the Internet.
If you register at our website as an insider, which takes all of 30 seconds, we'd simply capture your email address and your name. You've got access to pretty much everything we put up. Not necessarily in the moment we put it up. We don't want to cannibalize our newsstand sales.
Right.
Because, like I said, we're the only magazine in Orange County that depends on newsstand sales. We don't just throw it in the driveway. We don't just, you know, put it in stacks outside of stores.
Right.
So we flight our digital content in a way that does not cannibalize our print magazine while it's on the newsstand. So you may have to wait 3 weeks to get, you know, the Center of the Universe story when it comes out in the October 2013 issue. But you'll get it eventually. And there's a deep archive of our past stories. And I should also say, in our print magazine, we have a limited number of pages for what we call our dining guide, which is our list of 180 restaurants that we recommend. And a short, you know, capsule review of each one. In any given issue, we can only get about 70 of those restaurants into that dining guide.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to our website, there's a searchable database.
Uh-huh.
So if you say, I want Persian food in Irvine, up pop 5 of our top reviewed, you know, Persian places in Irvine. Mm-hmm. You can do it by geography. You can do it by price range. You can do it by cuisine. It's a really useful tool. And you know, if you contrast that with Yelp, for example, which has its own, you know, purpose, let's face it, I use Yelp too.
I worry about Yelp, though, because it really just it glorifies the negative over the positive, or you have to do the opposite, and you're just stuffing it with fake stuff just to counterbalance the two pissed off people that came into your place here.
And they're not particularly informed. That's not to say everybody who reviews on Yelp is not well informed, but Gretchen Kurtz, who's our restaurant reviewer, has been covering dining in Orange County for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
She knows what kitchens the chef worked in 20 years ago.
Wow.
Who trained him,
yes,
you know,
right.
Who his sous chef was.
That's a great story.
Yeah. And she's able to bring that kind of depth and context to it. I can talk about the restaurant scene in Orange County as credibly as anybody because I read her. And that's, you know, people are always asking me, and I feel qualified to give an opinion, even though I may not have been to these restaurants, because she has told me, you know, this is the history of this. This is how it came about.
See, again, history. You got to have some knowledge of what went into this here. You're looking for reporters to give you something that you can't just pull together yourself here.
Mm-hmm.
They've got some expertise. They've got some talent. They know how to put it into words. They know how to pull all these threads together. And that's what we're sorely missing in this world today. We're overwhelmed with little bits of instant bits of information like Yelp and all these other things here, but nobody's there to synthesize it and pull it all together for you.
Yep. And that's the niche we think we can still fill in Orange County.
Okay. Any other questions, Brian? Sorry, Don.
No, I'm just kind of curious. So here you are today. And so what do you see changing in terms of maybe what things might look like maybe a couple of years from now?
You know, it was explained to me about 3 years ago that if you think about the transition of music from CDs to digital, okay, that was about a 10-year process.
Right.
It took that long for people to get comfortable, the vast majority of people to get comfortable buying their music online. 3 years ago, we were about halfway through that process between print and digital. I think there will come a day, not too far down the road, when most people are comfortable reading a magazine digitally. You know, I think there will always be a print audience. That will always be a segment of what we do, I think.
Right.
But let's not fear that. That's just an inevitable reality.
I agree with you. Embrace it. And just as long as you're kind of got to stay tapped into your readership and understand, you know, constantly this emerging trend that is going more digital. And I think you've done a great job, though, by just complementing it, though. I mean, by seeing the value of the print publication in terms of what it's good for and who likes to read that, and supporting that with some of your engagement with your audience and your community. But also, you're right, you have to have a digital presence. And obviously the younger generation is moving, you know, very fast, just totally digital.
How do you think the digital publications will differ from the written publications? Will they just be the same thing? It'll be columns of written words, or is it going to be much more interactive? That's what everybody keeps thinking.
Well, we've just relaunched our website so that it is reactive. In other words, you don't just go and read in columns. You know, it formats the content on that page, whether it be your smartphone or your tablet, into something that's optimized for that particular medium.
Mm-hmm.
It works pretty well. It's not a bad way to read a magazine.
But do you think there's been a lot of debate about this, where people are going to stop and keep hitting links to get, you know, in the same way you used to look at footnotes or something, you're going to hit this and you can click on it and suddenly a video pops up and then somehow you're going to come back to the narrative? Or does that just confuse the storytelling here?
You know, I don't think it does. I look at, you know, if I can click on a link and it takes me to a video of something that I'm not getting from the story that I'm reading, it's an add-on. Okay, for example, we did a short piece on a young girl named Umi Garrett who at age 14 gave a TED Talk just a few weeks ago.
Wow.
Because she's a world-renowned concert pianist. We can't listen to her play in the print magazine.
Right.
But if you're reading that story online and you want to hear, okay, what's the fuss about? Okay, we videotaped, you know, her doing a three-minute, you know, thing.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
If you can give people those, you know, not just you know, a little bit more, but something significantly different than what you can offer in print, there's a real life there. And getting people to understand that and pay for it is the challenge. And we're going to be dealing with that for a while.
Will you ever go to a paid section of the content like the Wall Street Journal or the Orange County Register has attempted to do? Their paywall didn't seem to work. They've taken most of it down, it seems like.
Yeah, I think you have to, you know, there's an organization here in Orange County that is an interesting model to me. It's Entrepreneur Media. They publish Entrepreneur Magazine.
Right around the corner here. Yeah.
You've seen their sign along the 405. They make most of their money by selling databases. You know, they collect information, business-oriented information about small businesses. They collect them into vast databases. Yeah, they publish a magazine, but what they're really selling is information, and
sure,
they're selling it in digestible form in databases. That's kind of an interesting business model.
Didn't know that, yeah. One more way you can try and monetize this effort here and find ways to make money off. Because somebody's got to pay for it. I mean,
right,
that's the problem. Journalists aren't going to work for free, and publishers aren't going to publish content for free. And does it become, some people think it's public grants and other things from wealthy people who want to keep this alive, or it's the PBS model, it's people donating to keep it alive. It's something other than just a subscription. We struggle with that here at the network. You know, we obviously charge a certain fee to have the hosts come in. We don't take everybody that comes in, but if you're willing to do, we do have to cover that through production charge, and then we do try and sell ads. But that's been a struggle because it's the ads are such narrowly focused subjects that it's hard to get a lot of people advertising in that.
Right. Yeah, it's a challenge. It certainly is.
All right. Well, the challenge is that we had so much to talk about, and we didn't have enough time to do it here. That's the real challenge. So I want to thank you both for coming. This has been fascinating. I'm going to replay this a lot, and I'm going to give everybody a copy of this so that we can you can all share it and put it through there. And I think that together, if we can have more of these kinds of discussions about where media is going or where we'd like it to go and other ways that people can, other media models that are working, then we can all somehow create a new media landscape for what is, by all definition, a pretty new and still emerging place called Orange County here. Thank you so much. You've been listening, as always, to the Orange County OC Spotlight, where we talk to the most interesting people doing the most fascinating things right here in your own backyard, right here in Orange County's only community radio station, octalkradio.net.